Let's it's 7:30. We'll get started. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff, hosting the Atlas Society Senior Fellow Rob Trzynski, answering, is religion necessary for a free society? I'd ask everyone to please share the room and please raise your hand if you want to join the conversation. Provocative title, Rob, is religion necessary for a free society?
Okay, so the answer is no. Next question.
Usually you have a slightly longer open.
I'll do a slightly longer standard conservative argument that's made, that they say, well, the usual viewpoint is that, you know, secular liberalism is riding off of and depending on a religious foundation that it rejects, right? So it's, you know, secular liberalism is essentially parasitic, that what's required is the cultural conditions for a free society are created by religious belief. And this ties into the conservative view that therefore, in order to have a free society, we have to be doing things to encourage and support and promote religious belief. So it's usually their way for saying we need to be less free so that we could support and promote and have the government promoting religious belief in order so that we can, you know, we can save freedom. And, you know, in the hands of the sort of nationalists, sort of Sohrab Ahmari, Patrick Deneen, you know, some of these the current guys, some of this sort of nationalist conservatives, it turns into sort of we have to burn the village in order to save it argument. You know, we need to have a monarchy or an established church in order to protect freedom. Well, once you've done that, there's not a whole lot of freedom left to protect. But it's worth taking on and taking seriously this argument about, do we need religion to be the foundation for a free society? And, you know, there are, aside from the modern conservatives, there are statements you can find from the founding fathers. I'm going to be returning to these later, but there are statements you can find from the American founders saying, you know, this will work for a moral, this, I think Adams said, this constitution, this system of government will work for a moral and religious people, but not for people who aren't that way. So they believed that religion was necessary. Now, we're going to talk a little bit later about what they actually meant by religion. But I want to take this on the first level of just historically, what's the record historically in terms of, do you need religion for a free society? Well, have highly religious societies generally been free historically? And the answer is no. You know, you could look to, now people cite the founders and they say, well, the founders said this and, you know, America was religious and we were a free society. But if you look at, you know, that's more the exception than the rule. If you look at the history of highly religious societies, you know, for 1,000 years after during and after the collapse of the Roman Empire, for over 1,000 years, we had societies that were highly religious, that were organized around religion as the central principle, far more so than today. And they were generally, they were monarchical, they were feudal, they did not have anywhere near the degree of personal freedom and political freedom that we have today. And, you know, I this is a bone of contention I have with conservative writers. So a couple of years back, Jonah Goldberg wrote a book on the Enlightenment. And he tried to sort of rely on secular arguments, but towards the end, he brings back in the religious arguments. And he says, well, you know, Christianity had a role in creating this miracle of the Enlightenment and this huge amount of progress in human society. Since, you know, it took about 1,600 years for it to happen, but one could argue that, you know, the fuse had been lit and the conditions have been created. And I thought, well, if it takes 1,600 years for an idea introduced as the central organizing principle of a society, and it takes 1,600 years for it to lead to a free society and to progress and all that sort of thing, maybe that's not what led to it. Maybe there was something else introduced a lot more recently. Now, we're going to get to that before I'm done here. So, you know, and of course, you could look around the world. You know, Iran is a highly religious society and is very unfree. You know, the Muslim world has a serious problem with the religious fanatics take over society and they make it into a hellscape, into the most unfree societies we see in the world. Or right now, there's a whole war going on in Ukraine that is partly because Vladimir Putin has this relationship with Patriarch Kirill, the head of the top guy in the Russian Orthodox Church. and this doctrine of the new Rome, that Moscow is the successor, the inheritor of the Roman Empire, and specifically as a defender of Christianity, as the promoter and defender of the Christian religion. You know, now that after the fall of the Byzantine Empire and the takeover of Constantinople by the Muslims, that banner went to the Russians, and Russia is the defender of Christianity, and that's part of what he's using as the basis for this Russian imperialism, for invading and destroying and this whole plan to, you know, create concentration camps for Ukrainians. So you have this example going on right now of a highly religious argument, at least. I'm not sure Russia is really all that religious right now, but it's kind of a Potemkin village kind of thing. They have a great show of being religious, but underneath, not so much. But, you know, the religion is being used and has been used throughout all of history. Religion has been used to justify all sorts of different forms of tyranny. So we have, just on a historical basis, a lot of reason to doubt this narrative that, oh, religion is really necessary for free society, because you've had that condition of a highly religious society and not had freedom a whole bunch of times. And it's been a long-standing trend throughout all of history. So let's look to the basic ideas that religion introduces and why they would be, what is the argument that the ideas of religion would be necessary for a free society? Well, the usual argument here is you need religion in order to have morality. And this is the argument that the founding fathers gave, is, you know, you need to have a people who are moral enough to basically to follow the principles of a free society, moral enough to restrain themselves from the urge to just simply grab whatever they can from their neighbors by looting them, or to be intolerant and force them to do and violate and force them to go against their conscience. It requires this sort of moral principle, this moral restraint. You have to have a regard that, yes, there's something more important than my urge of the moment to impose my will or my feelings or the preferences of my group or tribe on other people. So, you know, the principle of individual rights, the principle of a free society, is one of moral restraint in that sense. And so they said, well, you have to have some basis of morality for that. Now, here's the thing that philosophically I find interesting about this argument, and I call it the argument of a love. It's a phrase from Nietzsche, where he talks about the idea of to love man for God's sake. And this is the idea that, you can't love your fellow man or cooperate with your fellow man simply for the sake of your own, or for the sake of your fellow man, simply out of respect for humanity. You have to have some larger, wider principle. So you have to do it for the sake of God and not for man, because man himself is so worthless. And Nietzsche basically endorsed this position. Man himself is so weak and worthless and not worth restraining yourself for, that you need to have some higher thing that you have regard for in order to be able to love your fellow man, or to have respect for your fellow man. And that's sort of the idea here, is that, you know, if you, the contradiction here is essentially you're being given a secular reason for having morality. You're saying we need morality so we can have a free society, so everybody can be better off, right? So the real argument is, if we organize our society around a moral code that allows for individual rights and for freedom, everybody will be better off. Well, that's a totally secular argument. So if that's the reason that you need to have morality, why not just give that as the reason? Everybody should be moral. Everybody should have a regard for morality, because we'll all be better off if we follow these rules. That's a totally rational, secular, sensible way of making the argument. You could actually get people to sign up for it. And I'll argue later that that is actually how things generally work today. That's why people follow certain basic moral rules. All right, so then, you know, there's this sort of contradiction of saying, well, we have this totally secular reason why we have to have morality, so we can have a free society and everybody would be better off. But therefore, that means we need to have God. Well, you just gave a secular reason. You just showed that we don't need God in there. And that, I think, is sort of the giveaway, that the purpose of this argument is not to be able to allow us to have morality or to have a free society. It's that people want us, what they really do is they want us to believe in God. That's the fundamental conviction. And then they're looking around for, well, you have to believe in God so you can have a free society. But it's not a free society that's the goal. It's the belief in God that's the goal. The argument that you need it for a free society is sort of an ad hoc thing that's come up with in order to get people, push them towards the religious outlook of this philosophically, is that a free society depends not just on morality, it also depends very specifically on the idea of respect for other people's minds. It depends on the idea that you have to be other people through persuasion, through discussion, through by presenting evidence, his own, you know, free will, his own judgment, personal judgment, using his own rational faculty to agree with your course of action and to agree to cooperate with you in whatever it is that you're trying to do. So it requires respect for reason. And there's where we have the real problem with this argument that we need religion as the basis of a free society. Because the basic problem with religion is that religion is based on faith. It's based on belief in the absence of evidence, in the absence of rational argument. And of course, historically, this is why religious societies have been on, because they always enshrine, well, here's a religious authority. Here's the person who has access to the truth through, you know, through revelation, through faith. And that person, because he has access to the truth and because he's this religious authority, he then gets to impose that on everybody else. And it's not your job to question or to gainsay what these authorities say. Your job is to obey these authorities. And after all, if we let people believe whatever they want, then we're going to, we're going to have an irreligious society. We're going to have people doubting God. We're going to be falling away from the true faith. And that's going to, that's going to destroy our religious beliefs. So we can't have that. If religion is a central principle of a society, it becomes a faith-based and therefore an authority-based system and ends up being a system. All right. So here's the other thing is, so if this is all true philosophically, then what about America? What about the founding fathers? What about what they said about religion? Well, I'm going to very briefly go over this, and we can talk about it more if somebody's interested. If you actually look at, so one of the sources cited for this is Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, where he makes a big deal because he's, for reasons of his own, for his own philosophical convictions, he very much promotes this idea that, you know, religion is an essential part, an important part of what keeps the American society together and what makes it possible for them to have a free society. But if you look at what he actually says about Americans' religious beliefs, there's a great passage where he says, you know, the preacher in America is constantly talking about the value of morality for your well-being in this life, not for your salvation in the next life. And it's like, you know, they can't keep their eyes off of this world. And, you know, you get the impression that the purpose of religion and morality is entirely to get your to achieve your happiness here on earth. And the, you know, the afterlife, the next world doesn't matter at all to them. And that's absolutely true. What he was observing in America, I don't think he fully grasped this because he didn't know the history of it. But what he was observing in America, this is circa 1832, but this goes back, you know, a century in America, is the influence of something called natural religion. Natural religion was a highly enlightenmentized version of religion that was the common religious view among the founding fathers. From John Adams to Thomas Jefferson, it was the most common religious view held by the founders. Actually, there's a famous letter from Adams to Jefferson later on when they resumed their correspondence, where he says, you know, it's one quote that's often used by conservatives, where he says, the real revolution was in the hearts and minds of the American people. in their sense of their religious duties and obligations. So it sounds like, wow, the real American Revolution was religious. But in that letter, refers to as being responsible for this revolution in our sense of, in American sense of religion, was a Mayhew. Now, Jonathan Mayhew was a highly influential Boston preacher in the middle of the 18th century. He was influential on Adams and on a lot of the other guys who were in Boston who, you know, here in Virginia, we really made the American Revolution, but I hear they had something to do with it up in Boston too. So a bunch of those guys were influenced by Jonathan Mayhew. Well, Jonathan Mayhew was an advocate, a defender, a propagator of this natural religion viewpoint. And what makes natural religion natural, the natural part of it is, that so natural religion is contrasted to revealed religion. Revealed religion is religion that comes to you, theology that comes to you on the basis of revelation, on the basis of some of something that's written in the Bible or some prophet or somebody who has this, you know, a goes out in this desert and has a vision and tells you this is my vision of what God wants us to do. That's revealed religion. Natural religion is the idea that, well, maybe principles of theology and principles of morality can be derived from observation of the natural world. So you can see how totally enlightenmentized and really secularized this natural religion viewpoint is. And they even had this idea that somebody referred to it as the sacralization of reason. The idea that, well, and this comes really from John Locke, where he says, you know, God implanted us with the faculty of reason, therefore he must have intended for us to use the faculty of reason in all issues, including religion and including understanding, you know, what our purpose is here on the earth. And so therefore, all religious and moral principles should be derived from reason and observation of the world. Well, so, you know, the big showcase of America, you know, America is the big showcase for why we need religion at the basis of a free society. And what you find is they were basically Unitarian Universalists. I mean, they were sort of nominally religious, but with a highly secular outlook that was behind that, a secular Enlightenment influenced outlook. So that's my general statement as to why the case against the idea that we need religion as a basis for a free society, because historically, the actual basis for a free society was a mostly secular, quasi-secular, Enlightenment-based philosophy of individual rights and essentially an implicitly individualist philosophy. And so I think that the real successor to that is objectivism. Objectivism is a much fuller, more worked out, more complete version of, and of course, a fully secular version of that natural religion philosophy, actually at the basis of a free society.
All right, good. I have some stuff I could explore too, but we have TAS founder David Kelly here. Great to have him. Do you have a question for Rob? I don't know if you're able to unmute. You may need to leave and come back. But I'll start with mine. I mean, as you're saying this, it makes me, you know, so yes, these people, it's almost like it a free society can come as one religion is fading out and before a new one kind of takes hold. In this case, it would even be socialism. Or...
Scott, I don't think we can hear you well. Can you hear him?
Yeah, he sounds like I can hear
him. Can you hear me?
You sounded like you were at the bottom of a well. You sound better now.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, so, you know, is it that it's in between two religions, like Rome was, you know, the end of the gods and before Christianity led to a dark age. And now Christianity's kind of fading out and having that kind of secular view. And you know, at before, and that's what leads to a free society. The Enlightenment was kind of Christianity, but on the way out.
I wouldn't say the Enlightenment was Christianity on the, well, I suppose you could say it was Christianity on the way out. I think the best way to understand the intellectual context for the Enlightenment is the essence of the Renaissance was, it was the rediscovery of classical philosophy and the philosophy of the ancient Greeks and the culture all the cultural achievements of the Greeks and Romans and the classical world. But it was also an attempt to combine the two together, to say we're going to have all this great stuff from the classical world and Christianity at the same time. We're going to merge them together and combine them. Talking about a previous vacation, I'm trying to remember what war or disaster happened during this one. But in a previous vacation, I was in Florence. And if you're ever in Florence, there's the main cathedral, the one with the dome by Brunelleschi, really the birth of the Renaissance in Italy was the construction of that dome in 1421. But there's a tower next to it called the Giotto Campanile, the church. And the decorations were done by Giotto, the great Renaissance, the 14th century artist. And there's a series of carved reliefs along the couple stories of it. And it's fascinating to me that what's there is it's a combination of Christian saints and then ancient Greek scientists and mathematicians. They're all sort of mixed together. And it includes, these reliefs meant to represent the Christian virtues, faith, hope, and charity, as well as the Roman, the classical virtues. It's a similar thing. There's one of the first things done by, who's the guy who did the Birth of Venus painting? Botticelli. In the Uffizi Museum in Florence, there's this one of the first paintings done that they know was done by Botticelli was part of this seven panel painting. And the seven panels are the four classical virtues. Was it courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance, and faith, hope, and charity, the three Christian virtues. So there's this real attempt to say, okay, we're going to, in the ancient world, when Christianity took over, it destroyed. What has Athens to do with Jerusalem was the big rallying cry. They said, we're going to destroy all classical learning, all classical civilization. We don't need it. We just need Christianity. The Renaissance was trying to say, no, how about we can have both? Well, what happened is by the time you get to the Enlightenment, they're saying, well, maybe we don't really even need as much Christianity. Maybe we can, combine Christianity with even larger amounts of secular knowledge. Very few of the Enlightenment figures were outright atheists, although there were a few. But they were mixing Christianity with much, much larger doses of the classical outlook of knowledge, of reason and observation, and a this worldly outlook, a humanist outlook, the idea that the purpose of life is to enjoy human life here on earth rather than to do God's will so you get into heaven. So there is, it's just this increasing thing, tendency. Now, the problem you have is that by the 19th century, you start to get fully secular, or these supposed seemingly fully secular replacements for religion. They start to get to the point where people throw out religion altogether and have fully secular ideologies, but their fully secular ideologies are anti-humanist. They throw out the humanism along with that, and you get you get Marxism, and you get these totalitarian ideologies where we think of Marx as the big villain, but I would say the big villain is Auguste Comte, the guy who coined the term altruism and who also created the sort of religion of humanity, I think he called it, which was this very self-consciously a secular replacement for religion, which placed society in the place of God. And, society is the entity to which you would sacrifice everything. Society is the entity that rules everything. It is basically, it's a religion based on collectivism. And that really is very early in the 19th century. That ends up being, so they throw out everything that was good about natural religion and the Enlightenment outlook, and they replace it with something that's seemingly secular, but is really just replacing God with society and enshrining collectivism. And that's the real problem. So we never had the natural transition should have been from Enlightenment natural religion ideas to a philosophy, a proto-objectivist philosophy that would have been grounding all the principles, saying, well, all these principles, you could get all these moral principles from observation in the natural world, but you don't really need God in the equation. You don't need him, that concept, to get there, you could just induce morality from observation of the world and the requirements and the needs of human life in this world. And that's what we should have had, and we never got it. Instead, we got a, like I said, a collectivist replacement for religion.
I want to invite David to ask a question if you want to, if you're able to unmute. But
yes, I would like to ask Rob a question here. Rob, you know, I follow what you're saying about the Enlightenment and natural religion, and I agree totally. And conservatives are, you know, just making up a lot of, let's put it as, you know, tendentious interpretations of what the founding fathers said. But the fact is that on another front today, and you look at our economy today and our society, and people are doing incredible stuff in business, technology. They are operating by reason, you know, at very high levels all the time. And yet many of them go to church on Sunday or Bible study in the South during the week. And I'm wondering what is, you know, they clearly have internalized an ethic that is very similar to objectivism. They're productive, they're rational, they're the best of them have a lot of integrity in the way they function, and yet they are not, when they turn to the explicit issue of values, they feel they need a supernatural endorsement. And that's puzzled me for a long time, why that is. And I'm just wondering if you have any comment on that as a sociological issue.
Well, I don't, the sociological, I think, is not necessary. I think to some extent we can look, view it as, is an intellectual leap they have to make. Now, there are two aspects to this, in my observation. There are two aspects to this. One is that a lot of people are, I mean, that's the Sunday school effect, I call, which is a lot of people are actually drilled into their skulls at a very early age. You know, that's why you bring the kids to Sunday school when they're 5 years old. You know, you get to get them drilled into their head at a very early age that it's important to believe. And you know, I one of my closest friends growing up was from a highly religious family, and you know, had these little plaques on the wall say, "This I believe," and it was clear there was like this. He was a very smart guy, but there was, I think, this area roped off in his mind when he had to follow. If he had to follow a train of thought that would lead him to doubt religion, he couldn't follow it because he'd have this, you know, the Sunday school effect. He'd have this drummed into his head from such an early age. It would be very, very difficult for him. It would actually require, you know, for me, who was raised basically in a non-religious, you know, without having any particular dogma sort of drilled into my head, it's very easy for me to say, oh, well, I can dispense with religion, which I did at a very young age. But it was easy. It wasn't something I had to fight over because I didn't have that resistance. For somebody like that, it would require a very extraordinary effort. And then the second part of that is, if it then requires an extraordinary effort, you'd have to have really good arguments out there to show you, yes, this is okay. You can still have, you know, still be a good person, still have a decent society. You don't need this religious belief. And we don't have, I mean, you know, objectivism has those arguments. I'm not sure we always present them as well as we should for that audience. But, you know, if you're just in the culture in general, if you're not encountering, you know, outside of objectivism, there's really nobody making that, or not, there are very few people making that kind of argument in a really powerful and convincing way. So that even if you were inclined to say, maybe I should question it, that what, you know, the question is, well, what's the alternative as a foundation for morality, as a foundation for being a decent person, as a foundation for having a free society? Well, you know, you can look at this, the secular left, and they're not offering something that's really all that appealing. You know, they're just offering a new dogma, which has often some very, very bizarre things that they of their own that they expect you to believe. Bizarre and oftentimes very repugnant things that they expect you to believe. So I think it's a combination. The wider picture, I would say, is that secular morality is actually an enormous achievement. The idea of taking morality, which came, historically for thousands of years came up out of a religion, right, and saying that, no, we could separate it from that religious context. We could put it on a rational, scientific, philosophical foundation, and we can work out how to do that, and we can make it convincing, and we can work out all the details. That's an enormous achievement that I think really nobody did it until about, you know, 60, 70 years ago, depending on a little over 60 years ago, depending on when, you know, Ayn Rand was working on Atlas Shrugged. Nobody really managed, I mean, there are precursors that you could look at, but nobody really managed to accomplish it for the last 60 years out of all of human history. So no wonder people still have trouble with it.
But she thought we were freer before that.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, she thought the 19th century was the time where we were freest.
Politically and economically, yes. In terms of religious belief, you know, there was a case to make that you could say intellectually we were freer before that. And I think it's because you had the influence of the Enlightenment. But what happened with the Enlightenment, so if you had this sort of this natural religion view, which was common to the thinkers of the Enlightenment, you had this attempt to sort of have something that is essentially a secular philosophy. And by the way, I recommend, I got turned on to all this. To expand a little bit on the point about why people believe in God, to expand on all this, I first heard about natural religion and especially about Jonathan Mayhew from a friend of mine who wrote a book about it, academic historian who wrote a book about Mayhew. The book is called Father of Liberty. Author is Patrick Mullins. You can look him up. But he wrote, it's a really good book. It's an academic book, but very readable. And when he turned it on to me, he did it by reference to Joel Osteen. Now, if people know who Joel Osteen is.
I like him.
Oh, he is Lakewood Baptist Church or something like that? It's the largest, it's the most mega church in America. And he was one of the first big mega church evangelist preachers. But he has this sort of prosperity gospel, basically the purpose of religion is so you can be happy and successful. And he has a book called like Living Your Best Life Now. And of course, you know, the Babylon Bee type, the Babylon Bee was basically founded to make fun of guys like this because it regards them as totally anti-Christian, right? Christ wasn't living his best life now. He was living his worst life then. You know, he sacrificed himself on the cross. So these people regard this as totally, you know, against the spirit of Christianity, but it's totally in the spirit. It's the dumbed down, unintelligent version, the non-philosophical version of natural religion, you know, brought into the 21st century. So I think that's also one of the reasons why you have these people go to church on Sunday, but they go to church to hear Joel Osteen tell them about how, well, God wants you to be happy and be successful and have a great life. So, yeah, they're getting that same thing. But I think what happened in the 19th century is, for the most part, other than those leftovers like Joel Osteen, who are, you know, it's a significant thing out there, that sort of dumbs down non-philosophical version of that. But other than that, what happened is you had this thing that was sort of quasi-secular but also quasi-religious. And I think what happens in the 19th century is people either went full secular, and then, of course, when they went full secular, they went collectivist and materialist and all that. Or they went full religious. And you had, you know, the people who were religious didn't stick, as a general rule, with that the Enlightenment approach. They had a backlash against the Enlightenment. And it's not just Kant. It's also, you know, the sola scriptura. And there was this whole, by scripture alone, there was this whole rebellion against, I think somebody called it the God of the philosophers. There's a rebellion against the God of the philosophers. That God isn't something we go, and religion isn't something we should think about philosophically. It's something we should either explore through feelings, through faith, or through authority, through, you know, reading the Bible or looking at following the religious authorities. And there was, you know, that's where the real sort of fundamentalist back to basics version of Christianity. And that was really what became modern sort of conservative style of Christianity, for the most part.
That's fair. And I want to encourage everyone to share the room as well as raise your hand if you want to participate. I think that to the extent that you're praising the early guys like Jefferson and Adams, or, you know, the deists or the natural religionists, you know, in that same spirit, I mean, I think that maybe Joel Osteen is a kind of continuation of that, that you can kind of say, oh, they're being hypocrites or not being true to it. But that's kind of the incremental step of getting more rational. And even if these people can't, you know, get rid of their religious part, if they're able to compartmentalize and be free in most things, I mean, is it worth all the effort to try to change them on those last few parts?
Well, I mean, a lot of those people you're not going to change, so it's fine. And now I accept Joel Osteen and that sort of prosperity gospel thing as, you know, it's not the version of religion I'm worried about, right? So I'm not going to go out and go hammer and tongs against Joel Osteen, except that, of course, I think he gives Outlook a little bit of a bad name because he's this kind of opportunistic guy, right? He's one of these guys who talks a lot about religion. He's easy to make fun of, let's put it that way. But I think he's very much an intellectual lightweight. It's like a leftover of a more substantial intellectual movement. But certainly I don't view Joel Osteen or guys with those kinds of views as the enemy culturally. But the thing is that, again, it's because they are the leftover influence of a more rational, more humanistic version of Christianity. But I think what's happened, we have to, you know, take into account that what's happened is that version of Christianity has been sort of pushed back a little bit. It's no longer the sort of the wave of the future the way it was in the Enlightenment. And the, you know, the people who have retained their loyalty to religion, especially the conservative, the religious right, the Christian conservatives, are very much in favor of more of a, you know, let's go back to basics, so that old time religion kind of approach to Christianity.
I mean, they may say that, but there aren't that many that want to go to pre-Enlightenment standards.
Well, I mean, there's a growing movement there. If you talk about pre-Enlightenment, I mean, there is this sort of, you know, so one thing that happened, that First Things is a good example of this. So First Things was one of the leading Christian magazines on the sort of Christian right during the Reagan era. And a lot of the guys, Newhouse, I think was the guy's name who started it, Father Newhouse, they were Catholic conservatives who were also very classical liberal conservatives. Right, they were very pro-free market. They were, you know, very Reagan-esque, and really sort of like put meat on the bones of this idea that you have a Christianity that's compatible with free markets and free and classical liberalism in a free society. Well, what's happened to First Things in the last 10 years? After that old generation basically died off or retired, is it got taken over by the nationalist conservatives, who are very much enemies of, and openly declared enemies of liberalism, and not just liberalism in that sloppy sense that we tend to use today, where liberalism just means anybody on the left, most of whom are not liberals in any meaningful sense. But when they say they're against liberalism, they mean liberalism in our sense of the word, meaning advocacy of individualism and freedom. And specifically individual autonomy. The autonomy is their big enemy. And this is all very explicit. And First Things is one of the centers for this. So I think you see that change happening, especially in the last 10 years or so, at a place like from being a classical liberal Reagan-esque Catholicism, a version of Catholicism that's classical liberal and Reagan-esque, to a version of Catholicism that's much more traditionalist, much more anti-Enlightenment, much more openly illiberal. So don't discount that too much.
Yeah, I think that definitely exists. I think there's a phenomenon of as they feel they're, you know, losing their grip on cultural power, they just kind of lash out. I think that's even part of what this move for abortion is. It's like, get us a win on something.
Yep.
And so, but, you know, and
I don't know. I just, even with the Sohab Omari, I mean, can we, is there any potential to try to steer him in a better direction to say it's not all the Enlightenment? It's just, you know.
Well, I think with Sohab Omari, I think we should wait around for his next conversion to happen. History of, he was like a Marxist, and then he was a neoconservative, and then he was a Catholic, anti, you know, nationalist conservative. Yeah, it'll happen in a couple of years. He sticks with an ideology for three to five years, and then switches. This might be his final form, but you never know.
That's fair. I mean, I could talk to you the whole time. I want to open it up for people if you want to raise your hand and get involved with this. I think that you do see these periods. I mean, even from the Reformation, there was the Counter-Reformation, and there are little sparks of where it jumps up, but you're still looking at a 300-400 year trend of downward influence of traditional Judeo-Christian religion.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it goes from having a total monopoly 1,000 years ago to having, you know, this sense of being embattled. Now, I think the thing to really be concerned about, and I think in the long term, the thing to be more concerned about, I think you're right to some extent that I've got my hair on fire about this illiberal version, this illiberal nationalist version of the right, partly because I think they're basically wrecking the defense of a free society, that they're really sapping its strength at a time where we could use more allies. They're taking them away. But over the long term, I see the bigger threat is that the alternatives to a religious outlook, that, you know, what we need is a secular morality that will defend humanism, that will defend individualism, that will defend a free society. And that's the real thing to have our hair on fire over the long term, is that we don't have that. I mean, we have that ideology, but it's not widespread enough, that the dominant ideologies out there that are alternatives to religion are generally not adequate alternatives, or are just, you know, in a different direction.
Right. You alluded to that. You said that most people in the 19th century that went away from religion did so in a collectivist direction.
I have to look at most that require more scholarship to quantify it. But the version that certainly by the early 20th century, if you look at, you know, the Red Decade in the 20th, that became sort of the elite avant-garde modernist position, was some form of scientific socialism. Or a sort of Comtean, you know, religion of humanity that's based on collectivism. Yeah, that became had a very large impact, and I think that's what we're still struggling with, is that you have people, you know, the wokeism, you know, people have described this as a new religion, and it absolutely has a lot of the characteristics of religion that people just took the fundamentalist version of Christianity and secularized it and appropriated a lot of its characteristics, just with new, you know, catechisms in place of the old ones.
Yeah, absolutely. I read recently that I think Engels' original, what became the Communist Manifesto, was originally planned to be in the form of a confession of faith.
Yeah.
They wanted to, you know, share their principles that way. And I mean, I think they kind of saw it as a religion. You, like you said, with Comte, for example, I mean, they were trying to create that. And it was even a natural progression from this more benevolent 17th century God of nature, religion of nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Ayn Rand even had elements of that she brought in. She talked about this in, I think it's in her 25th anniversary introduction to the Fountainhead. She talked about how they're all, you know, religion has basically had this monopoly on the spiritual aspect of man's life. So there are all sorts of concepts from religion that she wanted to keep. Concepts of like worship and reverence and sacredness and things like that. That she said these are valid and necessary. Valid and necessary parts of our spiritual lives have this religious overtone, but it refers to something we actually have, a spiritual politics of not just saying, okay, you know, this is another way to dominate the individual with rule by authority, but by saying, you know, to liberate authority, but to have a morality based on, as opposed to the ones that are, you know, borrowing all the dominant characteristics of religion as an authority-based, anti-individual, a system built around submission, essentially, and giving it secular window dressing.
I think we might have touched on this before, if there's a place for almost objectivist rituals in building that kind of objectivist community, even in a secular way.
Yeah, I think there's some ground. Although actually, I've done a lot of thinking about what is it that would take the place of religion or religious worship in a rational society. Objectivism took over society. Or even in the corners of it where we do have our little enclaves, what would you have in place of, you know, going to church on Sunday? And I think what we have in place of that is we have art. You have art, you know, probably all of us have at one point been to an objectivist conference. So you also have, you go hear somebody give a lecture on history or philosophy. That's the equivalent, right? But also, for this experience, for the uplift, you would want to go see art performed. And I think it's interesting that Ayn Rand actually introduces that in a way in Gull's Gulch, in Atlas Shrugged. You know, what do the people do there in when they're not working in the gulch? Well, they go and they hear some classical music composed by Richard Halley. They have art. I think there's a mention of art being shown, or there's a play being put on. You know, they go experience something art. They use art as a way of bringing that spiritual experience, not necessarily from ritual. And it's not so much that you have a ritual, but rather that you have phase a substantive and gives you that experience. So I think in a fully rational and secular society, art would replace religion as the source of a spiritual experience that helps keep you grounded and keeps you connected to your philosophy, to your values.
David.
Scott, if I could jump in, I just had a thought about Rob's, this is David, I thought about Rob's latter point in your question. Two things. One is that, as valuable as art is, it's still a highly individual and activity of appreciation, and people with the same philosophy can easily differ on the forms of art that they find most inspiring. So I wouldn't put aside ritual. Over the years at the Atlas Society, we have, many people have suggested, not many, but we've had a number of presentations about what might be an objectivist kind of practice in terms of getting together. And so far, the only thing we found is conferences, which we don't do much money anymore. But the other thing, I wanted to ask is, years ago, I was wondering how many adherents of objectivism would it take for that to be a familiar term and just an accepted, if minority, position? And for example, like Buddhism in the US, mm-hmm. There are many more Buddhists worldwide, but there are something like 376 million. I'm looking at a chart that I did, and this is outdated, but a third of a million people who call themselves Buddhists. Now that includes, that's worldwide. So in America, it would be under 100,000.
Yeah.
What if objectivism, is there a number, and that, this is something I've thought about over the years, is there a number that would be a kind of an inflection point where objectivism would become just, oh, I'm an objectivist. Okay, yeah. You've got values, you've got standards. I'm a Christian, or I'm a Catholic, or I'm a Jew, or whatever. But, you know, I gotcha. You know, we're a tolerant society. As opposed to, you are, you know, the devil incarnate, because you don't believe in God, you don't believe all that stuff that we all hear way too many times.
Yeah.
I would like to know your thoughts, Rob, on what it would take to make objectivism, including rituals, but also just sheer numbers, a recognized way of life, way of thought, on a par with other major religions that are around today.
Yeah, that question. I think I thought of it. First of all, as to rituals, because it's such an individualist philosophy, I'm not sure you're going to get any one set of rituals. But of course, we also don't have that for traditional religion either. I mean, that's one of the things that's happened, especially in America, right? The breakup of the Catholic Church and its authority 500 years ago, 503 or 504, led to, you know, this splintering of this enormous number of different sects, and everybody's a member of their own little small church that has its own theology and its own its own rituals, and it's, oh, they do things differently, and you know, there's more songs in one church and there's fewer songs in another church, or different kinds of songs. That's already been highly fragmented. I think it's going to be highly fragmented for objectivists, because we're individualists, right? Everybody's going to seek out what they find most interesting. But what I would say is what the numbers are required to make it so that you could have this variety of different offerings in the objectivist space, and have them be able to have an audience, a large national audience. It's, you know, as somebody who makes a living in this field, more or less, I can tell you, it's a, you know, the small size of the movement makes it hard. You can't have somebody just start up a newsletter and be able to make a living writing a newsletter about objectivist ideas. It takes a lot of creativity and a lot of scrambling and ingenuity to do that. Whereas a larger movement would be able to support, you know, somebody would have a YouTube channel or a television, a cable TV channel or something that would be able to put out lots of content. And we'd have to be closer to the scale of possibly of a small religion or of one of these small sort of subcultures out there. I like to think of it in terms of, somebody did a calculation a number of years back about how many years it took for the number of Christians to double in the Roman Empire. Basically, you know, how many years went by where the doubling rate for the number of Christians. And it was like, you know, every 15 years they were doubling. Well, that's, you know, when you think about what happens when something doubles and it doubles again and it doubles again and it doubles again, you suddenly have that, you know, suddenly within a couple of, not that many cycles of doubling, suddenly they take over the entire society, which is what they did. I think we need to double about 5 times. I'm not sure we've doubled in the last 60 years, right? We need to increase 200, somewhere between 100 and, you know, 500,000 who would think of themselves as having some significant connection to objectivism. Enough to, you know, to seek out objectivist things, to be an audience, to be a market for it. That what I think would, but yeah, I think we need to double a number a couple more times, 3 to 5 more times to get close to that. And, but that would really, I mean, when you think about that, that's really what I think the goal is, or what the hope is. You can do that. Artists and novelists Ayn Rand didn't have an objectivist audience to sell her novels to. She had the American audience, just, you know, people who were not even aware of her ideas. But I do think you'd have more opportunities to have people who are the ideas, who are spending full time working on them, training in them, turning them into art or into ideas or into history or into things that would have this intellectual on the country and on a lot much larger scale than what we have now.
Maybe we should broaden it out to fans. Well, this is, this is like a whole new vein of bringing things up. But, I think what is it that, I guess I'm just thinking about in terms of objectivism being that next thing like you were talking about. Yeah. And, if it's not that, you think it probably would be something more collectivist that gets turned to.
We're already all the culture already is turning to and already has been turning to the collectivist alternatives because we don't have we don't have a successor to the Enlightenment, a successor to Enlightenment ideology. I don't think it's, we're all doomed if objectivism doesn't double three times in the next 20 years, which is not going to happen anyway. Even in my most optimistic moments, it's not going to happen. It's not that we're all doomed. It's that there are a lot of people who are groping and struggling toward this. And David mentioned the people who are, very productive, very rational in a lot of ways in their life. And then they go to church on Sunday or they tune into Joel Osteen on the TV or something like that. The great advantage we have is we're basically trying to sell people on a more consistent and more through a stronger foundation for the actual implicit creed on which they're living, for the way most people actually live their lives. And we're basically the only ones who can say, all right, we have a full philosophical explanation for why you live that way and why that's the best way to live. And we can answer all the arguments and we can show how this is, fully based on basic philosophical ideas. So we have that to offer, but we're offering it to people who already are implicitly, to a large extent, living on that. And that's why I think we're not doomed if objectivism doesn't take over right away. But we're always going to be vulnerable. Our society is always going to be vulnerable to those irrational and illiberal influences. I mean illiberal not just in the political sense of, leading to government regulations and controls or endangering free elections or something like that, but also illiberal culturally. That, the dogmatism. I don't know if people have been watching what's been going on at the Washington Post the last couple of days. They had, Dave Weigel, who writes for the Washington Post, who's actually one of the more and sort of a idiosyncratic guy, not really part of anybody's. A joke that some other staffer at the Washington Post decided was sexist. And she's been going on a tear for like three to four days now about how is it that the Washington Post is permitting this. The Washington Post, leadership caved and they suspended Dave Weigel over this stupid retweet. I thought it was established not retweets are not endorsements, but there we go. It's this sort of internal office culture that's come straight from college campuses and straight from Twitter right into the heart of the Washington Post. A censorious church lady type of person who says, oh, that's sexist. I don't like what you're doing. They can shut the whole organization down and they can basically bully everybody else. That's the illiberal culture that we have. And of course, in answer to that, we get the people who are the sort of the nationalist conservatives and the traditionalists who say, yes, we need that, but with religion. So what we're really looking to defend is not just politically liberalism, but free thought, a society of free thinking people who are not living in constant terror of somebody accusing them of violating some dogma. And I think, like I said, I think that's the implicit American creed, but there's always going to be threats to it until we have a firm and more widely accepted philosophical foundation to say, yes, this is why, we don't need these religious or dogmas. We don't need to have everybody, following some faith. That we have a foundation for saying an individualist foundation, philosophically, for the creed that people actually want to live on.
Well, that's great. Good way to end it. I appreciate the topic. Tomorrow at 7 p.m., Stephen Hicks will be continuing his series, John Locke and Rational Individualism. Then Thursday, back here on Clubhouse at 4 p.m. Eastern, Jason Hill will be discussing Ayn Rand and Civil Disobedience, a critical assessment. In the meantime, we'll be on hiatus for a month.
I'll see you on early July. Enjoy your
vacation.
I absolutely need it. This has been a grueling couple of years.
Well, I'm glad you're getting it. We look forward to your return. In the meantime, I'm Scott Schiff and hope to see you at the other events this week. Thanks to everyone who joined.
Thanks, everyone.
Take care.